You're listening to the Forest School Podcast. Delicious waffle chat about education, nature connection, child development, community building, and lots more. Hosted by Lewis Ames and Wem Sutherland. Guys, I don't have a script for this advert. That's because this advert is for the incredible Tawi stove. T-A-W-I stove. So many people already have been asking us about this. We've been posting it on our social media. We've been talking about it on the podcast. It is this incredible stove. I said to someone the other day, it's like a rocket stove and then some. It's super efficient with fuel. It's got multiple different cooking spots. And because it's all sat on a big bucket of water, if I was working in schools and I was getting to that point at the end of a session where you have to tidy up and get the fire bowl away and you've got to either pour water on it and warp your fire bowl or stand there and wait for it to cool down for ages, I would have wished I'd had a Tawi stove, because you could just push all the fuel down the back of the stove into the water and you are packed up and ready to go. So head to carbonfarmers.world and check out the Tawi stove today, and you can speed up your whole process at the end of a school session and get you home way quicker and be more efficient with the wood that you are burning. So go to carbonfarmers.world and check out the Tawi stoves today.
Hello, listeners. Welcome. We are here with Michael Follett. Some people might have heard of Michael through his work with OPAL, Outdoor Play and Learning. And I'm so excited to have you on, Michael, because I followed your work for a while. And really looking forward to speaking with you. And I was especially prompted to get in touch with you because I've seen that you've just launched the plan for play at the House of Commons. Yes. And I thought, that would be a great topic to kind of dive into. Thank you for joining us. For those people who haven't heard about Outdoor Play and Learning and your work, would you like to give a little brief sort of summary of what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my background is I grew up in a nursery school. My mum ran a nursery school in our house for 21 years. I went on to do an education degree and I trained to be a play worker and ended up driving a double-decker play bus around North Yorkshire, amazing, which is great fun. I then went on to train as an early years teacher. Didn't really get on with teaching, having done play work. It's quite a common thing, I think. And eventually I ended up as head of play in two local authorities, first of all Bath and North East Somerset, and then in South Gloucestershire Council, where I was embedded in the school improvement team. So I was overall in charge of play strategy and play policy, but I was also embedded in the school improvement team. And what that did was give me contact with all of the head teachers in South Gloucestershire. And I tried to make play better at Bath and North East Somerset, and I didn't know what I was doing, so I wasted a lot of time training lunchtime supervisors in playground games. And the only thing I discovered from that is lunchtime supervisors weren't in charge of primary schools. So when I went across to South Gloss, I decided that you have to really start at the top. Start with the head teachers, start with the senior leaders. So I developed a program really looking at the ways that my colleagues worked in school improvement and taking a very structured school improvement approach to changing the entire culture and planning of primary schools, really so that play was taken as seriously as a curricular area like maths or English. Because maths, English and play all take up 20% of a school day. And that's really what the principles of OPAL are. We take a very, very structured school improvement approach to creating something that's incredibly unstructured, which is proper, freely chosen, self-directed, intrinsically motivated play. That's where we're at.
That's the good stuff.
Oh my gosh, it's so important, isn't it? And for any listeners who aren't familiar with OPAL's work, I think, have you still got on your website the amazing video footage of average sort of play times at schools where you guys have worked? Because I remember
we have, years ago. We do. We've got one of St. Michael's. We also have a YouTube channel that's currently called, I think it's called OPAL Playtime. Mm-hmm. And it's got a selection of one. There's a great one from Scotland, one from Knock Law Primary in the Northeast, one from Morningside in London. Really just to show that any kind of school can have fantastic play. It doesn't have to be. St. Michael's has got wonderful grounds. And actually, some of our best schools are like Fairlight in Brighton that has a postage stamp of tarmac sunk into the ground and 550 children on it. And they do fantastically. In fact, they were one of five heads that came to the House of Commons to receive their Opal Honours Awards, being the longest standing best schools in the country.
Wow.
I really feel like I can, I'm not going to, but I could go off on a real tangent now about play working, because I think my journey particularly was the other way around, in that I went to teaching straight out of uni and went, something isn't right about this, went into doing forest school, and then found out subsequently about play working. And I'm in my 30s and I look back, I go, oh, that would have been really good. Where did this go? Like, where was that as a thing? And to the point where, so Wem and I run forest school training courses, and we go above and beyond what's the set curriculum, and we do massive amount of times on the play work principles and all of that in, because it's so, like, I don't know anybody that's come across the play work principles and really engaged with them and not gone away and gone, right, okay, invigorated now to go and get this into schools. And so that kind of brings us, I guess, to this plan for play that you guys have put together, which is such a, like, it's very condensed in that I feel like this could have been a way bigger document. Was it something that you had to pare down quite a lot to get, you know, this is the right evidence for this and this is, you know?
Yeah, it was. We've had a really good relationship with the All Party Parliamentary Group for Fit and Healthy Childhood for quite a long time. And my colleague, Neil Coleman, sits on that. And he built up really good relationships with the MPs on that committee, especially Kim Leadbeater, who really led on the plan for play. And the clerk, the secretary to that group, I think her name is Helen Clark, knows all about how to put policy reports together. From my point of view, the driver was particularly around schools. And we want a really, really simple message, one that anybody could understand. So our line is, play is 20% of what a school does. Why would any senior leader not plan for 20% of what their school does? So we're saying, whoever you are, Ofsted, DfE, just help schools realise that they need a plan for 20% of what their school delivers. It's bonkers that they don't have it.
Yeah. Even things like in the report, as I said, it's very condensed, and there are some things in there that are facts that we all know, but we don't really investigate very much, like the fact, you know, about training for playtime supervisors. But even something as basic as the ratios, I suddenly thought, oh my god, like, in no other field of childcare or education is that just so ignored. It's so surprising, isn't it, that there is no set government legislation for the ratios at playtime in a school. And something as simple as that could have such a huge impact upon playtime, couldn't it? Because it's going to affect staffing levels, and it's got to affect funding as well, which is one of the points that the plan makes, is that supervision costs a lot of money, costs are rising, funding is decreasing. And so those are the places where it gets pinched, and its importance and its you know, the plans for that time of the day dwindle and dwindle.
Yeah, well, we want to point out that doing play in schools is really, really economical. Mm-hmm. So currently in the UK, we spend £750 million a year supervising school playtimes really badly.
Mm.
And the other kind of branch of what we're doing in Opal is we're sponsoring, we're paying for the development of an NVQ level 3 for playwork in schools.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Because we want to say, look, the workforce should be fit for purpose. The workforce is just not fit for purpose. They are delivering a fifth of what schools do. There's no plan from the top, and there's no suitable training for the people that do it. And schools, you know, some schools have way too many people. The presence of adults in the play environment can be just as harmful as it can be beneficial.
Yeah.
And having too many people interfering and don't do this, don't do that, get off that, is just as bad as not having sufficient supervision.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned training there. And like, one of the things, again, that's in the report is there's two kind of points where you're talking about it's the perception of risk and also the perception of that, like, rough and tumble play gets labelled as aggression or violence, mm-hmm. and that is a massive component of that. Could easily be something that just comes up in training. It wouldn't take the world to go, okay, here's how you understand that. These are the benefits. This is the stuff going on. But I can see how, if you are in charge of 200 children on a concrete rectangle, that your risk balance, your risk benefit analysis is just out the window, because you're just on crowd control at that point, aren't you, really?
Yeah, I think, I mean, rough and tumble is really interesting. My colleague, Curti Birkenbeil, his thing is rough and tumble play, and he thinks it is the single most important form of play. And Anthony Pellegrini has written books and books just about rough and tumble play and its role in the development of empathy and regulation, self-regulation. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Pellegrini pointed out that the difference between children's perception of when rough and tumble has gone too far and adults is about 80% different.
Wow.
So, I just look at my two dogs. They're collie spaniel Labrador crosses, and they play fight all the time. They understand the language absolutely perfectly, and they've got their play growl, and dogs do a play bow, which is, you know, the front feet down, bum in the air, tail wagging, and they have a specific play growl, and then occasionally one will bite the other on the ear a bit too hard. And there'll be a yelp, and they'll step back, and they'll look at each other and go, what?
Yeah.
You know, if my dogs can do that, I'm sure children can do that.
Yeah.
But we don't give them the chance to work it out, do we?
The author Heather Schumacher on an episode a little while ago, talking about her book, It's Okay Not to Share. And she's a big advocate of rough and tumble play. And she called it a puppy play.
Yes.
And said, like, it's, you know, it's a super, we have a big, it's like a big scramble net. It's probably about 3 meters by 5 meters. We suspend it up in the trees. And because it sags, the kids inevitably sort of roll into each other. And we had a volunteer with us the other week who was looking a bit nervous about it and going, oh, well, they're rolling into each other. And I was going, okay, they are. But the benefits are, like you say, the empathy that comes through, the understanding, the physical sensations of all this, you know, body stuff. Yes. They might get knocked very slightly. They're always okay. We're on hand for bigger things, but the benefits of that kind of rough and tumble play is so huge. And you're right, like you say in this report, like it's such a shame to do people a disservice by not giving them access to that. And I was wondering as well, because it kind of linked to in this, you're talking about some of the reasons that play is in decline, like historically. And you mentioned the lack of outdoor spaces and the lack of the way that children are brought indoors more and more. And it occurred to me that there's definitely something there about those outdoor unsupervised spaces might have been more opportunities for that development of empathy and things, and having everything supervised, like you're saying, with too many adults, and having everything be structured is very detrimental.
Hey, listeners, do you like learning new things? I know you do. You're listening to this podcast where you are obviously signed up for improving yourself and bettering your skills. Skillshare might have something for you. Skillshare is an online learning platform with thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people just like us. From nature photography to wilderness survival skills, Skillshare offers a wide range of courses taught by experts in their field. You can learn at your own pace, at your own schedule, and from anywhere in the world. And here's the best part. As a listener of the Forest School podcast, you can get an exclusive savings on your Skillshare subscription. So check out the show notes for this episode to find the code to get a discount on your Skillshare subscription. So why wait? Expand your knowledge, unleash your creativity, and take your outdoor teaching skills to the next level with Skillshare.
We do a sort of a line at Opal that the biggest barriers, certainly to play in schools, are hurty and dirty. just because people sort of lost the idea that it's okay for children to get bumps and bruises and scratches and grazes, and actually it's very good for them to do that. And also, clothing should be there to suit the needs of childhood. And what's happening is childhood is being changed to suit the needs of the clothing. And that really distresses me when we go in and schools say they can't do this, they can't do that, because they're going to get their shoes dirty or their trousers dirty. And that's really, if you stop and think about that, we're changing the nature of childhood because of the stupid clothes that we put children in, it does bug me.
There was quite a big fight at primary school that my children used to go to about the colour of the school polo shirts, because the school insisted on white polo shirts. And some parents were like, I cannot get these clean. And my child loves to play football, loves to skid on the grass and the mud, and they are just ruined instantly. Please, school, can you just change them to any other dark colour? And the school was very resistant to that. And they, oh, it looks very smart. And it's like, well, they don't look smart if children are actually playing. And something as simple as that, that might not, you know, that could be included in a plan for these times about clothing. And obviously there is a kind of pressure on parents then, isn't there? That if the children are coming home absolutely filthy, there is a pressure in terms of laundry and time and money and electricity charges are going through the roof and all the rest of it. So perhaps that's something else that needs to also be factored in terms of, does the school provide clothes for playtime?
Well, like often happens in forest school, don't we, for art lessons? But and that takes
us, you know, look at the three of us, we're wearing gray and black, you know, there's a good reason for that.
Yeah, I
can wear a white shirt for 10 minutes before there's ketchup, marmalade.
I've got a white shirt on, but there's only, I can't zip my hoodie any further down than this, so that's
so I have to be fair to my colleagues in the report that although my particular emphasis is on the plan for play for schools, the report more generally is saying, as society, we have to plan for play, because the changes in modern society have meant that play used to happen accidentally in childhood. Mm. I grew up in the 70s. Nobody needed to worry about me getting enough play. I was off and out all the time. But modern childhood has changed dramatically. And children have disappeared from public space. Children's time is so structured. We're putting them in clothes they can't play in. We're giving them technology that they're on for hours and hours and hours a day. So I think it's just a wake-up call that don't assume that play is happening in childhood anymore, because it's not. And we need to think about it everywhere that children are, in schools, in public spaces, in neighbourhoods, when children visit prisons, when they're in hospitals. Like, children need to play.
That prison section was so interesting, and that I had never considered. And so for people that maybe haven't got to the reading the full report, please do go and read it, people listening. But there's to summarize, there's a bit where they're talking about access to play for adults who are in prison and their children, and how the focus to begin with was on intergenerational reoffending. Mm. Is that the right word? But saying that it's not necessarily just about that, it is the rights of that child to have a space to play with their parent. And it's that, you know, incarceration doesn't just impact the rights of that person that's been incarcerated, it is also impacting the rights of the play. And I found that to be really interesting. And one of the things that I really liked about this report was a lot of things that it's been a little bugbear of mine for ages, where I switch off from things if they are advocating for play, and then at the end, the advocation for play is better maths results, or the advocation is better, they don't wiggle in their seats, you know. And it really, like, you go, oh, this was all still just a tool to get that other thing. But this report doesn't do, was that something that you had to consciously aim for? Is that just something that naturally comes out when you are through your advocacy?
I think generally people involved in play work come at it from the angle very much of Article 31 from the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. It is a human right for every child to have fantastic play in their lives. And that's not meant to be an instrumental approach to play. It's not meant to make them fitter or do maths more or whatever. It is because it's their right, and therefore it's our responsibility to make sure that right is met. I have to confess that when we're working with schools, we're like undercover agents for play. You know, we are the secret service of play. We sell it to schools on the benefits. You'll get more time as a head teacher, and not to have children lining up outside your classroom. You'll get more teaching time. We do that so that we can get in and get the play to children. Mm-hmm. And we talk about the intrinsic benefits of play and the instrumental benefits of play. And yes, we will sell the instrumental benefits of play, because that means that actually we can reach thousands and thousands of children. I think we worked out that we've reached over 1 million children so far with the Opal program.
Wow.
Yeah. It supports funding as well, doesn't it? If you can kind of give all of the reasons for the benefits of play, including, you know, improved academic performance or reduced behavioural incidents and things like that, then when schools are deciding how to spend their budget, it just gives them another few tick boxes to fill in to, you know, put money that in that direction. Another thing in the report that was interesting was highlighting the impact of COVID in the UK upon children's play. I was quite surprised. It says that 69%, I think, of parents actually noticed a detrimental impact on their children's play during lockdowns, primarily because it was contact with family and friends and things. And that isn't something that's talked about much. There's lots of chat about, the academic performance of children when they've missed out on schooling, and that sort of almost died to death as well, didn't it? There's lots of chat about that, tutoring programs and things, and but no actual stuff on the emotional impacts in terms of play and the physical impacts in terms of play that children have missed out on during COVID. Was that something you guys especially wanted to kind of promote in this report?
Well, it was, and partly because we work in schools all the time. And now we're in the UK, actually, we've now got 43 mentors delivering Opal across the whole UK. And all the time, schools tell us the impact of COVID on that whole generation of children has been really, really difficult. They came back in not knowing how to self-regulate, not knowing how to share, not knowing how to use their imaginations or creativity. When you think about, we talk about play is the way that children learn everything that cannot be taught. Mm. And teachers are great for things that can be taught, but actually most of what a child needs to learn in life cannot be taught. They need to learn, and play is the mechanism for them to learn those things. And in COVID, that was taken away. So it's not really surprising that children have struggled, because they haven't been given access to that mechanism that lets them learn about winning and losing, lets them learn about being creative, lets them learn that actually when you're playing with a group of other children, everybody else has got their own agenda and you have to work things out and things aren't going to go your way. So it has had a massive, massive impact on schools, and they've found it really difficult. I think that's partly why we saw a massive spike in demand for Opal, because the schools finally realized that play actually was a very important process, and you can't just expect to turf the children outside with a handful of supervisors on minimum wage and zero training and think that things are going to, no plan, and think that things are going to go all right.
I mean, that's where it's going to show up as well in terms of schools being worried about behaviour. And I used to work in a secondary school where that exact thing happened. So it was an all boys state secondary in Hackney, and playtime used to be an hour for lunch, and they used to be able to go off site as well and go where they pleased. And then they stopped them going off site, but then they were in basically like, it was like a prison yard. It was Victorian school with buildings on all sides. And then they didn't have enough space because they sold the AstroTurf to a development company. So the space was shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. Behavioral incidents were going up. And so they dealt with that by halving break time. They were like, okay, well, if we only give them half an hour, no one has a chance to get into a fight. So everyone's just calmer. And I could see it made logical sense in that situation. But in terms of, you know, children have been through these traumatic times with COVID, and where those emotions or that lack of practice at those skills that you're saying is going to emerge is in break time. So you can see, and playtime, you can see where schools might be then tempted to go, okay, well, this is just too much. We'll shorten it. We'll set up different activities for them to do. Actually, they can sit indoors and go on the computers instead, which is happening at my daughter's school, and things like that, you know. And it's like, it's actually, instead of kind of looking at the results that are happening in play and going, actually, what we need is more play and more help with play and more, you know, more support and more training. It's going, okay, well, don't even let them do that. So where is it going to come out? Where are these?
Imagine if you could do that with a maths lesson. My year threes are, sorry, call a spade, they're crap at maths. So we're going to half maths, right? And then if they still don't get it, we're gonna do fun. We just don't do maths anymore, right? Because they
it's
were
too much hassle. It's too much hassle. It. Yeah.
Yeah. That's. Have you seen the video that Unilever Persil did a few years ago about the prisoners in the American prison?
Yes, about the amount of outtime play.
Yeah, they're talking to them about what would happen if their outside, their yard time was cut down from 2 hours to 1 hour. And they're saying, man, there would be all sorts of problems kicking off. That would be inhuman. And then they say to them, do you know there's a group of people who have less than 1 hour yard time, and that's children. And they're very shocked by that notion. So, yeah, I... You know, schools are lovely, well-intentioned places, but just everybody is so busy and so everybody's agendas are so packed. Nobody has the chance to just step back and say, what is life like for a child? Mm-hmm. It's that Kennedy thing, isn't it? Well, what we're always asking children to do the stuff for us, but we don't actually think, well, what do they need from us to be happy and well-adjusted? And what is it that a child needs to be a happy, well-adjusted child? And children are so different, and schools are so very, very single in the kind of child that they cater for. It's playtimes might be the only outlet when you get to be yourself.
I'm going to say that I was so pleased to see that Forest School made an appearance in the report, and that as Forest School increases in the UK and schools become more aware of it and actually do build into their curriculums, that is another place apart from lunchtimes and playtimes where children will get the chance to play. And I was wondering about what, if you were kind of imagining an ideal future, and obviously there's lots of action points in this report throughout, which are really helpful and really succinct. And I was wondering about what role you might see Forest School as having in promoting and improving the access to good quality play overall. If we're kind of imagining a rosy tinted future, what role you see Forest School as playing in that?
I think there's a real sliding scale with play from my 1970s upbringing, which was absolutely no adult oversight whatsoever. I did whatever I wanted with whomever I wanted in my own time. And then there's adventure playgrounds where you've got adults who are trained in playwork who pretty much support the children to do whatever they want. And then we've got down a peg from that as schools. And what we're trying to say is that as much as possible, we're going to bring in play that's informed by the playwork principles. And I think Forest School teachers, again, are on a very big scale. You know, some are taking lessons outside and doing them in a forest, which is fine. There's nothing wrong from that, as long as you don't call it play. It's, you know, it might be playful learning, but it's not the freest form of play.
Yeah.
And I think schools should offer the whole range. I think they should offer the freest possible play that they can. And they should offer playful learning, and they should offer outdoor learning, and they should embrace all of it. I think a lot of children learn better outside than they do inside. I remember a piece of work. Now, I don't cite my academic sources, but it was from, I think, a university in South Wales that found that children ask 20 times more questions with outdoor learning than indoor learning.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, they actually counted the questions that children asked in certain lessons, and the ones outside were just so interested in everything around them, the bugs, the wind, the leaves, why the clouds, that shape.
Mm-hmm.
I think the play world and play work can really overlap with Forest School, and I think lessons can overlap with Forest School, and that's fine. As long as we as adults know where we are on that scale.
Yeah.
That's it, isn't it? It's yeah, we, as I said, we kind of really promote play in our own forest school setting and training of adults. But so many adults who are working with children or have worked with children in the past have become conditioned into what it says in the report about, or learning is education, which is this, and it's become narrower and narrower and narrower as to what learning and education means and what it entails. So even those of us adults who are drawn towards forest school and drawn towards creating a place where intrinsically motivated and freely chosen play can happen, still maybe feel some kind of guilt and shame about, or what are they learning? You know, I was having a conversation recently with one of our trainees about, you know, she was just giving herself such a hard time about, I can see that they're being really pro-social and really relaxed and they're really exploring, but I should be doing X, Y, Z. I should be pushing the learning. And I sort of had to kind of go, well, do you? Like, it is happening. And it's, so even people who are well-intentioned and are pushed to feel guilty that they're not delivering a more school-like experience, or, you know, how are they going to measure the impact of it and things like this. It's very, it's become so narrow.
I think we struggle, and teachers struggle with the idea that children can learn when they're not being taught.
Yeah.
And you know, teaching and learning are not a completely tight relationship. Children will learn all sorts of things that teachers don't teach them. Yeah. And that's not to say that good teachers can't have a fantastic impact on children's learning, but there's just so much. I mean, how can you teach a love of the outdoors? How can you teach children to appreciate how beautiful a bug is? You can't do that until they've held a little bug in their hand and seen it and just been awe-inspired by it. There's no teacher in the world that can teach that. They have to go and experience it.
Hey, outdoor leaders, do you ever get back from a long day of teaching out in the woods and you feel completely drained and you've just got zero energy to cook? I know I do. I definitely have been there. We've all been there. That's why HelloFresh is the perfect solution for busy teachers and outdoor leaders like us. HelloFresh delivers fresh pre-portioned ingredients and delicious recipes right to your door. So no more after-school shopping trips like in a rush, and there's no more mealtime meltdowns where you just don't have any more decisions to be made, please. HelloFresh offers a variety of meal plans to suit your dietary needs, all with easy-to-follow instructions that take less than 30 minutes to prepare. Imagine spending less time in the kitchen worrying and more time exploring the outdoors and recharging at the end of the day for your next session. HelloFresh wants to help Forest School podcast listeners enjoy delicious and convenient meals. Head over to the show notes for this episode to find a special link that will unlock a discount on your first HelloFresh box. So ditch meal planning stress and spend more time in nature with HelloFresh.
And I guess that word we keep coming back to, isn't it, is that intrinsic thing. It's, you know, even for some people, if you made them stand there and you go, hold your hand out, I'm going to put this in your hand, might still not get that experience, that, in quotes, I guess, lesson from doing that, because they haven't chosen to do that. They might not have been ready to do that. They might not, you know, it's not the day for them. It's not the bug, which is often one of the things that's more difficult about facilitating play as opposed to facilitating like a lesson. A lesson can have a limited number of resources that you apply to each student, either, you know, in turn, or you go, all right, everybody's getting the same thing, or this is what we need. And I know that a lot of Opal's work has been around facilitating. I think I saw in a Guardian article that they called a lot of junk play, which I would take issue with the term, but you know, that kind of like recycled materials and things that might not traditionally be considered play items, but that come up in adventure playgrounds, come up in some forest schools, come up in Opal's work. You know, can you tell us a bit about that thing of like using unconventional resources to facilitate play?
Yeah, well, I find it very useful when I'm doing the inset training with the teachers to say, have you heard of Nicholson's theory of loose parts? And they go, oh, no, there's a theory. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's a theory. There's an exponential increase in the value of a play environment for every loose part that's added. And they're going, oh, really? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Nicholson was a landscape architect, Scandinavian, and saw that the parks he designed were being largely ignored by children, and the children were playing next to his park with traffic cones and planks and car bonnets. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote a paper, I think it was called Why We Should Stop Cheating Children. Mm-hmm. That was the subheading of it. And it was setting out this idea that play is not on things. Play is mainly with things.
Yeah.
And mainly what children need in a play environment is agency, the power to control, manipulate, combine, construct, destruct, transport. And so if you put stuff into a play environment, it really barely matters what it is. Children's imaginations are so incredible that they will use that stuff and combine it. And because of the nature of the play type, so symbolic play, if you've got a traffic cone, an adult thinks, well, that's a traffic cone. It's put for traffic.
Yeah.
But for children, with symbolic play, it doesn't even have to have anything to do with a traffic cone. It can be your grandma. It can be a horse. Mm. It can be a Porsche.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter. So, yeah, we like the term loose parts because it moves it away from the idea that it's junk. It's a treasure, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, the schools that we work with, we kind of go on the proportion of four loose parts to one child, mm-hmm. as being a good yeah. proportion.
Yeah, we did a podcast a little while ago where we were just really delving into the loose parts theory and stuff, and we were talking about how important that like abundance is.
Yes.
You know, that not just one to one, or you know, to yes, one between abundance. Two. Like
good word.
It's the abundance that makes it. And then we were talking about and the degree to which you, particularly because we work in a forest setting, so like the degree to which you can do that, like hoarding, foraging, the like all the how many pine cones can I get? I can just get more of them and more of them and more of them, and that is such a fleeting experience if your play world is confined to stuff where it's always one to one or one between two, and that joy of like just collecting more and more. And like you say, loose parts, the more you have, the more. I don't think we got to anywhere in the episode where we were like, well, that would be the limit on loose parts. except for maybe considering the tidying needs of whatever space you're in. But then you could argue that maybe the tidying is optional, because when another group come out, or the same group on a different day, those loose parts are presenting springboards in a different way because they're coming with different emotions. So
yeah,
again,
it's a found opportunity, like, isn't it?
Like you were saying about how much of it is for us, you know, like the school uniforms, how much is a tidy playground for the adults, or for the we're going to take some pictures for the brochure and it doesn't look great if you've put, but you know, think to the right people, a play area full of tires and bits of wood and string and everything would look great. We'd be like, right, yeah, that's the place to send the kids off to. I wanted to say that one of the things that Opal have done that has really stuck with me for the longest time is the journeying between activity spots. I've sort of fudged that in a weird way. You're talking about designing play spaces and sort of
yes.
outdoor playgrounds and going, well, between the swings and the roundabout should be stepping stones, or should be some things that you interact with on the way. And that's really stayed with me in terms of what we do in the woods, and going, okay, so what's the journey look like between the treehouse and the digging hole? Or what's and sometimes it's natural springboards, you know, the woods just offers an interesting tree on the way. And sometimes it's like, okay, well, what if we make this path curve round there? I know this is now, there's lots of Opal's work is about talking to head teachers and like systematic change. Do you personally still have an interest in that, like play space architecture and things?
Yeah. It's probably a good time to plug my book, but I wrote a book called Creating Excellence in Primary School Playtimes. And in that, I actually outlined these four design principles. Part of it was triggered by my aggravation of the wobbly bridge. So one of the bits of play equipment that you'll find on many school playgrounds is the wobbly bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a bridge that wobbles a bit, and it's isolated on 10 square meters of rubberized surface.
Yeah.
And this bridge doesn't go from anywhere to anywhere. Well, what bridge ever didn't go over anything and didn't lead from one place to another? You know, what is the point of a bridge over nothing from nowhere to nowhere else? And what happens to wobbly bridges is usually girls go and hang out on it. It's kind of a slightly movie bench. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a bridge should go over a ravine and it should cross from a castle to a store or something.
Yeah.
Really, that design work was quite influenced by somebody called Neil DaCosta, who is married to Robin Moore, who teaches in outdoor play and learning, actually in University of South Carolina. And her research was about how much more active children are in places that have complex networks of destinations and journeys, and that the least useful space is a big open space for children's play. That is where that's the least functional for play, sociability, creativity. And that is exactly what 99% of children get.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's to do with like versatility, isn't it? It's the, I guess the thought process is like, well, if it's a big open space, it could be football or netball, or they can play, not bulldogs, bulldogs band, you must never play bulldog. Mm. But you know, things like that, where it's like, oh, well, an open space gives them all these opportunities. It's like, well, yeah, but does it? Because then they're having to do so much work to get anything going in there. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas the little bits of like, here's a, you know, a journey to go on, here's some interactive stuff, here's some stuff that you can move around, is again just enough to go, doesn't need an adult involved necessarily, doesn't need a lesson on like, okay, everybody line up, we're going to use the wobbly bridge now, one at a time, here we go, you know, like,
yeah,
you don't need to be taught how to use these structures.
It's the third Tuesday in the month, therefore it is your turn to cross the wobbly bridge from right to left.
Yeah.
I really think you could do a good...
I've seen it. Lunchtime supervisor
really?
Standing next to the wobbly bridge.
No, you're way.
To go on there on Tuesday. You can only cross from right to left.
Wow.
That is so far removed from play.
Yeah.
I don't know if they contributed, but Make Space for Girls is a fantastic organisation. I don't know if you've had them on. I was recently lucky enough to... We had a symposium at Oxford University that Naomi Lott put on, who's author of the new book on the right of the child to play from conception to implementation. And I've really, really noticed school playgrounds, there's a huge gender bias, an unconscious gender bias, that about 25% of boys dominate about 85% of the space with their football.
Yeah.
And if you don't like football, you're going to get a football in the face.
Yeah.
If you don't like football, you're pretty much dragged into it, or you're just cast aside to the corners. And
that was me.
Yeah.
I'm a football person. But you mentioned this in the report. There's a bit in here where you're talking about sports funding and sport and people at the sports premium and how much that's leaving some non-sporty children behind because the active parts of play are going to sports.
Well, I did a presentation a few years ago to lots of senior people, including the leadership of Sport England. And I showed them a slide and said, most of your sports premium is spent on making sporty boys more sporty.
Mm.
And that isn't what the money is for. The money's meant to be for the children that loathe and detest sport, to get them active and healthy. How can you get girls more active? How can you get neurodiverse children more active? How can you get the ones who like sport? They're all set. They like sport. That's fantastic. And actually, from the result of that talk, we got £250,000 grant from Sport England because they actually did recognise what we were saying.
That must have been a really guilty check to sign. After you've put that slide up, that's been a real tail between your legs. Okay.
We had a very good relationship with them. We brought them out and we showed them some local schools, and just said, look around you. Like, everybody's engaged. Very few children want to bunk off playtime. or don't bring in their kit so they can't play at playtime. And it shouldn't be an either or, but I think that the balance towards sport and PE and away from fun, active play is too strong in that direction.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we definitely would believe that Forest School can address is active play that isn't necessarily competitive sport. I mean, there might be some big wide games that might happen in Forest School. But if you look at how active children are when they're in a Forest School session, I mean, it's amazing. I have got your book and I was just flicking through to remind myself about, also, I think you talk there about designing play spaces also for social spaces, which kind of comes back to the thing about girls and designing play space for girls, and spaces for rest. And if you look at a group of children playing, there will be a percentage of them at any one time who are in a state of rest. And it doesn't mean they're not playing. We often, again, kind of sort of broadly think of play as being very on the go and very quick and fast moving, but it isn't always. It can be sitting together in a hammock, or it can be hanging out. And again, to some adults who don't know much about play because they haven't had the opportunity to learn, then observing that kind of play is maybe not given such a positive regard. We've had children come to our Forest School as holiday clubs sometimes, and in the same net that Lewis was describing earlier, girls especially, sitting in the net, talking, singing, chatting, and us, you know, in the past going, are they okay? Do I need to kind of tempt them out with some activities? What are their parents going to think when at the end of the day they go home and go, I just sat in a massive net and chatted? And obviously you make sure that they are aware of the opportunities around them and that they are very welcome and we're checking in that they're okay. But that is what they need. They want to. They're getting that sensory feedback from the net. They feel safe. They're away from other people. They're able to chat and sing without anyone overhearing them. All these kind of things that are so necessary, and that is also something that in play-based design might be overlooked, that it's that challenge of finding the safe, social, interesting resting spaces.
I did some really interesting research. So when I was first setting up Opal in parallel, the good friend of mine called Jeff Hill was running Scrap Store in Bristol. Sadly, Jeff died a few years ago, but he was very influential. He used to be a small business advisor and dropped in to advise Scrap Store in Bristol and never left. And turned it around to an incredibly successful social enterprise. And we did research together on loose parts, and we had lottery funding to do it. And that showed that at any one time, 60% of children want to be at rest in their play. They want to be in social gatherings, and in kind of the design of spaces and children's desires for space actually are very similar to adults. So the idea of placemaking is to make a place. Why would you go there? Why would you stay there? What would you do there? Are the kind of ideas of placemaking. And not to oversimplify, but out of the 16 play types, the kind of locomotor play, which is running around kicking each other or a ball, appeals to a certain set of maybe boys. And the other 15 play types of socio-dramatic play, role play, imaginative play, creative play, a lot of those are attractive to girls and a whole lot of boys as well. And that requires an improved play environment. So the tarmac rectangle is fine for locomotor play, but it doesn't stimulate or provide for all the other different types of play. Mm. And creating lots of interesting social spaces draws children in and makes them engaged.
And that's huge, isn't it? When we do our Forest School training, we get people to do like audits of their site and go through the 16 types and go, tell me all the places you can do this. Show me all the places. And it's quite fun, we make it out of little clay bits and sticks on the ground and go, do your playground, let's have a look at it. And one of the things that often comes up is like trying to balance that need of safety. Like we're saying, you know, they're often the lowest ratio supervised times in the day, but so many of those play types thrive in a degree, I'm hedging myself here, a degree of privacy or a degree of not being directly observed, and balancing those two things, again, like we're saying about, you know, the big open rectangle is good for observing and keeping an eye on lots of people easily at once. The small nooks and crannies and behind a bush they just find those spaces. It doesn't matter. I've been to every school and they go, yeah, the bottom of that bush is all hollowed out because that's where they, and we tell them not to go in there. And you're like, well, again, that just says they need a bit of privacy. And I think Opal had some stuff a while ago about we've got quite a lot of dens made out of pallets because they do that thing of you can see out so you know the tigers aren't coming, but you feel private so that you can experiment and do those things. It's been a while since I've looked into that stuff, but you know, is that privacy thing something that you're advocating for in place-based design still?
Yeah, absolutely. But because 60% of play is social, and social spaces require what we call permeable enclosure. Mm-hmm. If you go out for a drink with your friends, why wouldn't you expect you to sit in the middle of the car park and have a beer and say,
not
okay,
these days.
You want a beer, you know, there you are, sit in the car park and have it. You'd go into the pub. And then once you're in the pub, you probably wouldn't even choose the seats bang in the middle.
Yeah.
You'd choose the cubby. You'd probably have your back to the wall if you had a choice. You'd probably be able to look out the window. Like, there's certain things that make us feel at ease socially. And being permeably enclosed is one of the things that, as maybe as ex-hunter-gatherers, we like our backs covered when we're relaxing. That's just what we like. And schools are the opposite. Schools want to minimize the burden of supervision. And also they think that every child has to be seen at every moment, which is an impossible task anyway.
So we
do a lot of work with schools on how to supervise different models of supervision, but also the idea of managing risk and the dramatic changes in the perception, you know, how risk is managed. The new international standard 4980 is the international standard that says that contributor expertise, as in your expertise as a forest school leader, my expertise as a play person, is a huge contribution to how we assess the benefits and risks of a play environment.
Yes.
And that we should be giving equal weight to the benefit as to the risk. And that's still not a message that got through. You know, 20 years after the Health and Safety Executive first started issuing statements with Play England about risk and benefit being weighed up.
Yeah.
I don't know how many schools I go into that never heard of the benefit risk approach.
No.
Yeah. It's still, it's weirdly revolutionary, isn't it, for people to go, yeah, but is there anything? Oh, we never really thought of that. And again, that I feel like changes people's mindsets, where they're only thinking about risks, and so then you only think of the activity as risky, and so you, Michael, I could genuinely sit and chat, play with you all day. So for people that want to find out more about Opal, where can they go and do that? And also, before we go, I'd love to know what's next with this plan for play. What's what's going to happen in the future?
Okay, so the best place is just the Opal Wake website, outdoorplayandlearning.org.uk. There's a load of information. And the YouTube site, Opal Playtimes, or Opal Playtime, I should know it, has lots of videos. Where do we go next? I am on a single mission that every single child every single school child in the country is going to have an awesome playtime every single day. And until we get there, you know, we're not going to rest. We are really, really hoping that any future government gives the DfE a nudge and says, you should be asking schools about their plan for play, and Ofsted should be saying to schools, come on, where's your plan for 20% of what you do? That is something that makes sense. Opal's not going to do all of it. That's not the ambition. The ambition is that every school thinks about the quality of what they're providing in terms of their play and does so thoughtfully, just as you would with maths and literacy. You know, you don't just pay somebody minimum wage and stick them in the classroom and go, good luck.
Yeah.
hope it all goes well. I'm sure it will. I mean, that's the desire. We don't want any children missing out on using that important space in the day and not seeing it as just a filler.
Yeah.
Between lessons, we want it to be a really, really valuable part of the day. And it is just such a win-win. It's crazy that not everyone's doing it. Everybody wins. The children are happy and joyful. The head teachers get more time to just be head teachers. The lessons go better in the afternoon. I mean, yeah, it's hard work, but, you know, that's...
Well, there's no part of education that isn't.
No.
You know.
No. Schools are hard work.
Yeah. And with proper training, as you're saying, for play supervisors and proper wages and a proper job description that is actually inclusive of an understanding of play, hopefully you're going to get those people who actually really care about that. They're interested in it. They understand it. And that's going to become more fulfilling for those members of staff as well. Instead of, you know, I do pity supervisors at the moment who don't have that backup, and it's very stressful for them, isn't it? It's stressful for everybody.
Yeah, we try to say to the schools, look, we want to take those people on a journey from policing to play work. And honestly, play work is much more fun than policing.
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, Michael, thank you so much chatting with us. And personally, thank you for all the stuff that Opal has done over the years, because it's been, you know, immensely beneficial for us personally and for the children that we work with. So thank you for coming to us today.
Well, thank you for chatting with me. It's been great fun.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Cheers then.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to Rachel, Matthew and Kendall, Kefal, Gowan, Becca, Rosie, Julie, Rachel, Candice, Claire, Kylie, Louise, Michael and Anna.
And if you want to support this podcast, you can head to patreon.com/theforestschoolpodcast. Thanks so much, everybody.